From the moment I saw her, leaning against the rail, looking out into the night, I knew I had to save her.
Hey, miss, this way to the lifeboats.
What? Oh, the lifeboats? You're not serious.
Why, yes, as a matter of fact, I am. This way, come. It's bad, believe me. Oh, but she had already run back to the ballroom. I quickly made my way to the lifeboats and jumped into the last one, just as it cast off. I was safe, but I wish she'd come with me.
However, all is not lost if you, our listeners, will come with me for the next half hour here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Christopher Padden.
With Karen Black.
And this is the Lifeboat Show, where we discuss sustainable lifestyles and why we need them.
The content and opinions expressed on the Lifeboat Show are solely the responsibility of the producers and are not the expressed opinion of KMUN, its board of directors, or the Tillicum Foundation. This program was pre-recorded. Give us your feedback. Email us at thelifeboatshow@charter.net. We're the folks who are all about sustainable living. We began the Lifeboat Show with a lineup of experts, authors, speakers, public figures, who gave us the whys for living sustainably and self-sufficiently.
From there, we moved on to the hows. We brought you interviews with people who are actually making it happen in their communities.
This is our second program in a series on what you can do. Tools you can use personally, steps you can easily take to move towards sustainable self-sufficiency.
For more information, resources, and courses, visit our website at www.lifeboat.postcarbon.org. Or you can contact us at lifeboatshow@charter.net. Editions of the Lifeboat Show are archived on www.globalpublicmedia.com.
You're listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN, KTCB, and KCPB, simulcast on coastradio.org. Recently, while reading Countryside Magazine, a resource I've found very helpful, I ran across an article called "Do You Know Where Your Seeds Come From?" by Jerry Cook. We want to share a bit of it with you. Ready, Christopher?
Ready.
Somehow, I always thought the seeds, bulbs, and roots I purchased from mail-order companies came from a quaint American farm somewhere in the heartland with burgeoning rows of high-quality vegetables and flowers. I was wrong as a two-headed frog. It all started last August when I used a coupon from Gurney's to order asparagus roots. By the third week of September, my order hadn't arrived. I decided something was amiss and called the company.
Hello, customer service. How can I help you? Delivery date? Well, your order will arrive at the proper planting time for your zone, sometime near the beginning of December.
I was confused. How was I supposed to plant anything in Zone 3B in December?
Just put the crowns straight in the ground and mulch over them. They will be fine.
I expressed my doubts. I already checked with my local extension agent, the president of the local Master Gardener Association, and a knowledgeable neighbor before calling. No one thought planting asparagus after October in our area was a good idea. I would just take a refund.
Please hold while I check with someone.
Hello? Hello?
Spring Hill Nurseries. How may I help you?
Huh? I was holding for someone at Gurney's.
No problem. I'll transfer you.
Wait. Hello? Hello?
Henry Fields. How may I assist you?
What? I'm holding for Gurney's. What's going on?
Oh, not to worry. I'll transfer you.
I hope so. This isn't a toll-free number, and I'm racking up minutes running around in this long-distance circle. Hello? Hello? Great. But who hung up? Gurney's? Spring Hill Nurseries? Or Henry Fields? And how are we supposed to know who we're dealing with when we buy seed, and where does all the seed come from?
We're fortunate today to have Jerry Cook with us here on the Lifeboat Show. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, Christopher. Hi, Karen.
Welcome aboard.
Great to have you here. Jerry, how are we supposed to know who we're dealing with when we buy seed, and where does all this seed come from?
Well, I have to tell you, I was surprised to learn that the American nursery trade is a $39.6 billion a year industry. And when we're talking about that kind of money, we're talking about some pretty big players. Without a doubt, the largest of these players is Monsanto. It's estimated they control between 85 and 90% of the U.S. market.
Wow.
This includes the pesticide, herbicide, and fertilizer markets. They merge with their competition, they dominate genetic technology, and worst of all, they lobby the government to make saving seeds illegal. They've positioned themselves as the largest player in the gardening game. When we buy garden seed and supplies, most of the time we're buying from Monsanto. Doesn't matter who the retailer is.
So it doesn't matter what it says on the package of seeds.
No. It comes from the same place. Almost all of the seed is imported from the Far East, namely China.
Wow.
Almost all of it.
Absolutely incredible.
I don't think we can underscore this one other point too strongly, Jerry. Explain how loss of biodiversity relates to plant extinction as well as human starvation due to the vulnerability of monocropping to pests and diseases.
Most commercially available vegetable, fruit, and nut varieties stem from a very narrow genetic base. What transnational seed companies would try to pass off as good old-fashioned American ingenuity is in fact destroying biodiversity. New frankenseeds are bred to perform adequately, not spectacularly, adequately over a wide geographical area. With similar seed being grown all over the nation, the whole nation then becomes vulnerable to the same diseases and pests. This means that a disease or pest that in the past would have affected, say, only a crop in the Midwest is now a threat to the entire nation. It isn't difficult to imagine a scenario whereby the entire food supply of our country or any other country could be wiped out, causing mass starvation. The Irish potato famine of 1845 killed over 1 million people because only 2 varieties of potatoes were being grown and they were both destroyed by the blight. The effect on Ireland was devastating. The economy was destroyed, and 2 million people fled that country.
I know last year I checked the seed catalogs for the best variety of tomatoes for our region, and I planted several of them. They were off to a good start until we had a misty summer rain. Overnight, they all died. This year, I took no chances. In addition to changing my planting watering techniques, I planted 5 different varieties so that if one became diseased, hopefully the others wouldn't.
We followed the same technique with our fruit trees. I call it the ARC principle. We bought at least 2 of each type of fruit tree, and we chose different varieties for each of the trees in the pair.
The ARC principle is the perfect name for it. It's wise to plant more than one variety of everything, not only in case of crop failure, but to ensure against pest damage and disease damage. It's also a good idea to plant them in separate parts of the garden to prevent unwanted cross-pollination and to limit the exposure to pests and disease from one variety to the other.
You know, we've heard a well-known East Indian physicist, Vandana Shiva, speak a number of times. She's led a global effort to expose Monsanto, expose biopatenting, and educate people to the dangers of global corporate control over our food supply. She's published many books, such as Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply, Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, and Sustainable Agriculture and Food Security, The Impact of Globalization. Jerry, what can people accomplish at the local level? For example, what is a seed bank, and how hard is it to start one, and what are the best ways to store seeds?
Christopher, a seed bank is actually a corporate facility where seeds that have been removed from commercial production are kept. Since open-pollinated seed will not store indefinitely, it has to be propagated to ensure its survival. The chances of any of seed coming out of these commercial facilities and back onto the market are pretty slim. The best way to ensure that people can save their own seeds is to start a seed-saving club. And to that end, it simply takes a phone call from one neighbor to another saying, "Do you want to save some seed this year? Would you like to trade seed with me this year?" That's what I did. It worked beautifully.
Great.
That's a great idea.
And it's so simple.
It's incredibly simple. It's a great way to know your neighbors. It's a great way to pass on who you are to your neighbor and vice versa. What you grow and the stories behind what you grow is what makes us real to each other.
How difficult is it to save seeds? What do you have to do?
Most seeds can be harvested at the end of the season and stored in a plastic bag in a dry place for next season. It is just that simple. There are some seeds that are more complicated, beets, carrots, leeks, which require that you bring them in the first year, store them in sand, and then replant them the second year. They're called biennials, and then they produce seed. But for beginners, spinach, flowers, greens, beans, wonderful seeds. They're all just too simple to save. It's just you don't need a degree in anything to do this.
Can you extend the storage life of a seed by keeping them in your refrigerator?
People I know have kept them in their freezer. I don't know that I would recommend the refrigerator. It tends to be damp in there. And seeds need to be stored in a dry place. Most moisture level of seeds needs to be at 8% or lower, and the freezer will do it for you.
And you said store them in a plastic bag, so like an envelope, the kind of envelope they come in, or a small business envelope. Those aren't the best thing. It's really better to put them in plastic or like a baggie or something.
Some people prefer plastic. I actually store mine in little coin envelopes because I do trade a lot of seeds, and so I measure them out so everybody I trade with gets the exact same amount because I don't want any complaints.
Okay.
So I use the brown seed envelopes, and I have a special room in my home that I store seeds in. But when I started, plastic bags, freezer, that's how I did it.
Okay, great. Well, one big obstacle to people's understanding, I think, is our distance from the food we eat. My parents grew up on farms, and I did not, but I spent a good deal of time on farms of friends and relatives when I was a kid and was very aware of where our food comes from. As a teacher during the 90s, I worked with kids who didn't have this connection with the land. Food to them comes from packages kept on shelves in the supermarket. And I think most people have unconsciously slipped into this mindset these days, and who can blame them? There's absolutely no resemblance between the popular, say, kid snack of yellow paste corporately congealed in a two-part vacuum-sealed package with crackers on one side and a shelf life of several decades, and the white liquid that's squeezed from the udder of a female dairy animal. There's no resemblance visually. There's no resemblance nutritionally. There's no resemblance in the effect on the human body, the human brain, or the human attention span. And recently I was speaking with an educated woman who was complaining of the heat in her city, and she was mentioning that the farmers were suffering a drought, and she added kind of offhandedly that she'd hate to be a farmer so dependent on the weather, especially now that global warming is a proven fact. It was as though she had completely forgotten that she is dependent on those very farmers for the food she puts on the table. At a workshop I attended on rainwater catchment systems, a young man earnestly asked if it was all right to use the rainwater on his garden. Now think about it. The way Americans look at it, crop failures are no biggie for most of us. We won't have much of a selection at the supermarket, but we can just eat at a restaurant instead, right? And if these statements aren't shocking, drop everything you're doing right now and run, do not walk, to the nearest garden or farm you can reach. The very distance you may have to travel could be your first clue. Stick your hands into the soil and repeat after me. Dirt made my lunch.
Dirt made my lunch. Dirt made my lunch. Thank you, dirt. Thanks a bunch. For my salad, my sandwich, my milk, and my lunch. 'Cause dirt, you made my lunch.
You're tuned to Coast Community Radio.
And now is a great time to call in and pledge. Locally, 325-0010 or 1-800-518-0010.
Back on the Lifeboat Show with Jerry Cook. Let's define some positive terms, Jerry. How about explaining what are heirloom seeds, cross-pollinated seeds, and hybrid seeds?
Heirloom seeds are my absolute favorite seeds. Heirlooms are non-hybrid, or what we call standard seeds, and they come with a story. For example, a bean variety known as Cherokee Trail of Tears was carried through the Smoky Mountains on the Death March to Oklahoma in the winter of 1838.
Oh, my gosh.
Every time someone grows this variety, they are honoring the history of Native Americans. And there's nothing better than a seed with a story.
That's amazing.
Cross-pollination is when the pollen is moved via the wind, insects, or humans from one plant to the other. This doesn't mean that you're going to end up with some weird-looking fruit or vegetable. For instance, a Cortland apple requires a cross-pollinator. Regardless of what other apple you use to cross-pollinate, you're still going to get a Cortland apple. Same with blueberries. Almost all blueberries require cross-pollinators. And if you're growing a high bush blueberry and you cross-pollinate with a low bush variety, you're still going to get a high bush blueberry. It's just the way it works. Hybrids are another story. Hybrid is the result of a pollination between plants of a different species but in the same genus. An example is an F1 hybrid. That means it's a first-generation hybrid or a first cross. The problem with this is that hybrids are unstable. Their seeds don't grow true. If you plant a seed from a hybrid, you could get either parent, and the vigor of them probably isn't going to be great. They're not suitable for saving.
Now, there's another term, open pollinated.
Open pollinated is the result of a pollination between the plants of the same species and genus. These are the ones that you want to save for yourself. And most often, open-pollinated plants don't carry patents.
Okay, now if I'm going to save seeds from fruit or vegetables that I get at the store, what I'm understanding from what you've told us is that if I get commercially grown fruit or vegetables, the seeds are probably going to be sterile.
The seeds are more than likely sterile as a result of Terminator technology. Yes, they don't want you growing them.
Okay.
Because it's not profitable. You have to remember, this is a very large business, and the bottom line is profit.
Okay, so I would need to get organic. If I get organically grown vegetables or fruits, would those seeds be viable?
Not always. There are organic hybrids. It's amazing that the inroads large corporations are making into the organic movement. They're almost unstoppable, and the rules change so fast, it's very difficult for the average person to keep up with. The best way to save seeds is to make sure you are dealing with an open-pollinated or an heirloom variety. It should say it right on the package. And I would discourage people from saving seeds from produce they get at the store just because you don't know where it came from, who's handled it, or what's been done to it.
Mm. I remember coming across an article in a recent issue of, I think it was Mother Earth News, regarding melons. They were saying that there are several hundred varieties of melons that most people have never even seen or even heard of. The few varieties of melons that you see in the grocery store, they're chosen because they store for a long time, they can be transported easily, and they hold up to industrial commercial processing. It was amazing, all the different types of melons that are readily available if you grow them yourself.
Absolutely. And the problem is, it's not the melon's fault. But they are bred along with other things like tomatoes, bananas, lettuce, withstand the 1,500-mile or so trip from where they were grown to where they're going to end up. That's the problem. Almost all food in this country is transported at great distances to its final destination. Very rarely is a food grown by me, the farmer, and sold in my next town over 20 miles away. Almost never.
So to have an agricultural system that's dependent on such a long, vulnerable transport system, that's even one additional vulnerability that our food is subject to, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's a matter of national security, and that's a term people are loving to throw around these days,
mm-hmm.
But they overlook the obvious problems, the obvious threats, which is the vulnerable food supply.
And I think I read in your article that five or six companies total own 98% of all the seeds in the world.
That's correct. The six companies are companies you recognize: DuPont, Mitsui, Syngent, Aventis, Dow, and Monsanto. Now, Monsanto is the biggest player in the United States, but these other companies are going around through the back door, and they're buying up land and buying off farmers in developing countries. And these people are growing seeds and growing plants that there's no way American growers could possibly grow them for the same price that these people are. And I would encourage people, as painful as it is for us to speak about it, I would encourage people to look beyond the violence in Iraq and look at the Constitution that is being drawn up there, because the Constitution is being heavily influenced by Monsanto, where Iraqi citizens will not be allowed to grow their own seed or save their own seed. Now, here in the United States, they're going to get a fight when they try this, but in a war-torn country where so much going around, who's going to notice?
Well, that is exactly what Vandana Shiva's campaign has been about, or one of her many campaigns, is that they were doing that in India. And in India, the people revolted and saved their own seeds openly in defiance of government regulations, and I believe that they were able to repeal some of that legislation. She's worked with the UN, and this is big business. This is huge. This is going on all over the world, as you're saying. So it's something we need to be aware of. So saving seeds is not just a nice gardening tip. This is a vital service that people are doing for themselves and their community.
Absolutely. And saving seeds prevents us from being homogenized. With every seed we save and exchange, it helps us to develop grassroots relationships. And that's how we win. That's
exactly
how you do it. That's the way to go. The corporate devastation is almost complete, but there are pockets here and there, small pockets. Some of them are regional. Some of them are just local that are exchanging seeds and exchanging their stories. And I have a story I'd like to share with you.
Great.
That an older gentleman, long since passed, once shared with me. The old man grew hollyhocks. I love hollyhocks. And I was questioning one time about his hollyhocks, and Orville says to me, "Oh, you mean my naughty boy flowers?" I said, "Excuse me?" And he explained to me that when he was a young boy and working with Grandma in the garden, when he would act up, he would have to go stand near the corner post where the hollyhocks grew. And as he grew older, he called them the naughty boy flowers. And so Orville's been gone for years now, but every time I see hollyhocks, I smile because I'm sure somewhere amongst them is a fidgeting preschooler trying very hard not to be a naughty boy. And it's stories like that that we share with each other that make us laugh, that preserves who we are, that keeps us out of the blender.
Exactly. We read an excerpt from Joyce McGreevy's book, Gardening by Heart, on a previous show. That book is full of stories of gardening and sharing.
Yes.
I wanted to bring in one other example about the biodiversity heritage breed chickens, which is comparable to heirloom chickens or heirloom seeds, because, again, the commercial corporate farmers have reduced the breeds of chickens that they will raise to basically one, Leghorns, and they're trying to breed them so that they're featherless so they don't have to bother to pluck them. When you buy chicken in the store, there's basically one type of chicken that you're getting. That's it. All of the other varieties of bird has been pretty much eradicated as far as commercial growing is concerned. So when people raise chickens, if they can keep those heritage breeds alive, that again helps with the biodiversity. And biodiversity is important because
what would happen should all the chickens be wiped out? The bird flu scare that we keep getting beat about the head with. What if it did happen? Who would feed us? How would we recover from something like that? How would our economy recover? And people don't realize the extent that they consume in this country, the amount of food that we enjoy. If it weren't there, it would cause violence. It would cause economic disaster and hardship for the poorest of the poor first, then for the middle class. But within months, the upper echelons of our society would feel that pinch also.
Okay, thank you, Jerry.
Well, to give a good example of the way these corporations operate in a stealth mode, on June 28, 2006, the California Assembly Agriculture Committee passed a bill, SB 1056, that would take away local government authority over seed regulation, and it's specifically designed to override any local restrictions on genetically engineered crops and seeds. The language is almost identical to the bills passed into law on 14 other states since 2004. Apparently, it's part of a nationwide defensive strategy from the chemical biotech industry to avoid the kind of public debate sparked by local initiatives throughout the country, including ordinances such as Measure B in Marin County. And that's really to the point. Public debate and decision-making. The fact that Monsanto and other chemical biotech companies want to squash local-level debate and decision-making is no surprise considering their history of aggressively lobbying against even labeling their products.
This speaks to the issue of food sovereignty. The rights of local communities are being threatened by genetic engineering and biopatenting because of corporate control, the absolute dependence on external inputs, and the undermining of sustainable systems of agriculture. It's insidious, it's global, and if someone doesn't take a stand, no matter how small, by saving a seed, by raising a heritage chicken, by buying a gallon of organic milk, you are taking a stand. You are backing away from the abyss, and baby steps count.
Exactly. We want to give credit to Christian Heath for information on the California bill. You're listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN 91.9 Astoria and KTCB 89.5 Tillamook. Be sure to stay tuned for Lost Highway at 10. And be sure to send in your pledge. This is Pledge Drive Week, and we need your contributions to keep the old lifeboat afloat and to keep all the other shows going, too. So be sure to call in 325-0010 or 1-800-518-0010. Call now and pledge. Even a little bit will help.
I firmly believe that anyone, anywhere can be a gardener. I don't care if you live in a one-bedroom efficiency apartment. you can grow whatever you want to grow. All you need is the right attitude and a desire to play with the forces of nature. And that's what it is, playing. It's an interaction, and it's a wonderful feeling, and it gives you a story. Even if you blow it, you get to tell somebody you blew it. And you know what? Lots of people blow it sometimes. But when you have a success story, it's a wonderful thing. And I just encourage people to connect with each other and with the planet on that level.
Excellent idea.
I agree. I started out with a black thumb. I could kill almost any houseplant that was given to me. I grew to...
I won't let her near him anymore.
That's not true. I grew out of that a little bit, but it took a while. I used to love Sansevierias because it was impossible to kill them. They would grow in spite of me or to spite me. I wasn't sure. But I remember moving into a new rental, and there was a small raised bed out in the back, and I decided I was going to try to plant some things out there. So I went out, and I was going to weed first because I had heard that that's what you're supposed to do. So I saw this very lacy green stuff coming up out of there, and I thought, what the heck is this thing, this weed? And I pulled it out, and it was this beautiful carrot. I was so embarrassed. There was no one around for me to be embarrassed with, but I was embarrassed because here's somebody who grew up, the daughter of farmers, grew up around farms. I didn't even know what the top of a carrot looked like. So.
And what a wonderful surprise.
What a wonderful surprise.
And were you
surprise.
Not happy to see
I
that carrot?
I was totally ecstatic to see this lovely carrot, and I had a wonderful time eating it. And since then, I now know what carrots look like. I know what potatoes look like. I'm actually working in the garden every day and am working in our greenhouse, and I have a little starter set on my windowsill over the kitchen sink. So there's hope. Even if you think you're hopeless, even if you have a black thumb, believe me, you can recover from that. There's a song in the musical The Fantastics called Plant a Radish.
Children, you don't know until the seed is nearly grown. Just what you sown, so plant a carrot, get a carrot, not a Brussels sprout. That's why I love vegetables, you know what you're about.
He's singing about his children because he's not so sure that they're turning out the way that he was hoping they'd turn out. And he's kind of wishing he'd planted a garden instead, because then if you plant a radish, you get a radish. You don't get a rutabaga or a bean or something else.
So I encourage people to grow things and to share their stories with other people.
Thank you, Jerry, very much for being with us today.
I just want to thank you for having me on, and thank you for spreading the word and encouraging people to be more sustainable and to be more involved in their world.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us, Jerry.
Today on The Old Lifeboat, our special guest, teacher, writer, farmer, master gardener, and composter, Miss Jerry Cook, has given us a glimpse into what can happen if we do not begin taking our food sources much more seriously. For information on joining a local Seed Savers group, contact us at lifeboatshow@charter.net. Tune in next month, September 18th, when we interview Keith and Donna of EarthStar about the psychological, spiritual, emotional renewal that accompanies the self-sufficient life.
I want to hear that one.
I think you will.
Do we have room in our lifeboat to plant some seeds?
Of course. That's what a lifeboat is all about.
We'd better get heirloom seeds.
And start a seed bank.
When?
Today.
Today? You mean like right now?
Immediately, if not sooner.
Where do we get them?
Open pollinated seed companies.
Don't forget heirloom seeds.
And we can save our own seeds from this year's garden.
And we can trade seeds with our friends.
And save seeds with them in our seed bank.
This is going to be fun.
Uh-huh.